Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Full or part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway here from the posh studios of WAMC, high above Central Avenue in Albany, New York. I exaggerate only
slightly. How high?
How high do you have to be to think this is posh? Yes, exactly. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, and Ira Fussfeld, publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York. Wonderful place, Kingston.
Nice to see you both.
Absolutely great to see you. And we're here with a live audience from the New Visions program. This is a program focusing on law and government for high school, for extraordinary high school seniors. Hello, extraordinary seniors. A dozen students are here with Rich Bader, their coordinator and instructor. So we're glad to have them here, and we're going to enlighten them.
You know, he, Mr. Bader, has brought classes here before.
Yes.
And he keeps coming back.
Yeah,
now, does that say more about him or more about us? I'm not sure.
Trouble. Anyway, we got a lot to talk about this week because the biggest media story of the week, of course, has to do with a naked princess. The most monumental has to do with this practice of quotation approval. And, of course, the most embarrassing, perhaps, is the Newsweek cover story, Muslim Rage. So we've got a lot, and there's a lot more than that. So we got to get to work here. So maybe we start with the salacious. What do you think about
salacious? Let's go salacious.
The hoop-de-doo
over 6 points, salacious.
the photographs of Kate Middleton topless, and there previously have been some of her sister Pippa. And
do we have any idea where they got them from?
We do.
We do.
Well, we don't know specifically that a freelancer, we believe, or a staffer for a magazine in France took the pictures from apparently as far away as a half a mile. Which is incredible. What the Today Show did an experiment. They had a paparazzi on
I believe the singular via paparazzo.
A paparazzo, or is it a paparazzi? they had one. He was standing on the other side of the East River in Brooklyn Heights, and he shot a picture of an NBC correspondent across the river in Manhattan from about a half a mile away.
So was she topless?
She was not.
Okay.
Not that I know. They were showing her from the rear.
Uh-huh.
So that's how the pictures came about. So the question is, should the pictures have been printed and all of that kind of stuff? And,
absolutely.
And I think, now that you asked, that if the photographer didn't do anything illegal, and I don't know what the rules are over there, then it was fair game. They're not pictures that I would print in the Daily Freeman, I certainly would print them if I was that sort of magazine and if it was my stock and trade.
It is odd, you know, I don't quite understand why, if you're the Duchess of Cambridge, you would take off your shirt in a public place. I don't know that there's an expectation of privacy when you are a person in that public a role. I mean, I don't disrobe in public.
Well, they would claim they weren't in a public place. They were in a chateau in the south of France, many meters away from the public. But, you know, there's too many ways where that can be violated. Witness these pictures, and they should have understood that.
So I don't want to be seen as a conspiratorialist necessarily, but let me ask you guys a question. Remember when Al Gore kissed Tipper?
Mm-hmm.
Remember the kiss?
The kiss.
I think to this day, even though they are now divorced, that they did it on purpose because they wanted to humanize the Gores.
Ah.
So the question here is, always is, when you say, I don't know why she would take off her shirt, is whether or not, to some degree, they knew what they were doing, and number one. And number two, because the paparazzi, as we know, after all, Diana certainly understood about paparazzi and all the rest of it, that I think it may have humanized her a little bit.
The new face of royalty, the younger.
I think, in fact, we may find out that she's more popular now than she's ever been. What confuses me, always has confused me, is why this is such a big deal.
Right.
I happen to be a nudist at heart, you know, and therefore
that's a good place for you to be a nudist. But
so I don't really understand. I mean, I read National Geographic when I was a little kid.
Well, I disagree. I mean, who knows whether there
was so pompous.
I don't know that there was an ulterior motive. I do not believe that they believed that they were going to be photographed. I think they really wanted to be private. By all accounts, Prince William is, as one would expect, still haunted by what happened to his mother and the whole paparazzi or paparazzi.
But he knew about paparazzi, doesn't he?
The point is that I think they actually did think that they were going to have their privacy at this location, and now they've learned otherwise.
Yeah. You know, one of the interesting things is the judge in France ordered the magazine to turn over the photographs, which is really an anachronism. I mean, what's he going to do, yeah. turn over negatives? There are no negatives. Yeah. Once something is digitally created, it exists. Doubt. So you can turn over something, but I don't know what you can possibly do.
By the way, have you seen the pictures?
No, actually, I haven't seen the pictures. I've seen Pippa.
Have you seen the pictures?
No, I looked for them, but I didn't find them.
I can tell you on the air where to find them, or off the air, which, I mean, it's pretty easy. It's Googleable. You go to the second publication, the Italian magazine, which is called Chi, C-H-I.
And oh, right.
Their website is, you can Google them.
Boy, are we going to get mail.
Not that I was looking for anything other than journalistic reasons, knowing that we were going to be discussing.
Always.
Oh, actually, I do read that magazine, but just for the stories.
Yeah, of course. We all do. So that's media@wamc.org if you'd like to join the conversation. media@wamc.org or 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206 is where you find WAMC. Now, about quotation approval, because that's an important topic.
It is.
This is something, you know, I guess it's been a long time since I've been a reporter. I stopped full-time reporting in 1991, but I had no idea, notwithstanding the fact that a bunch of reporters obviously work for me, I had no idea that there was a widespread practice of reporters in Washington especially who submit quotations that they have taken from a person in an interview and give them back to that person or that person's press staff for approval prior to publication, and that this is a condition of being allowed to sit down with this individual. I'm rather stunned by this. Didn't know that until I read an article by Jeremy Peters in the New York Times in July that revealed that this is a widespread practice among journalists in Washington.
I happen to think, taking a different tack than you, I happen to think it's a good idea, because what I've said to people is, I want to check this with you, but I want to make sure, I want you to understand that you don't have the right to say I can't use it. In the interest of accuracy, I'm letting you take a look at this.
I think that's fine.
That's good journalism.
That's fine. Yeah. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But it's exactly what you're objecting to that is what people are doing. The press office is saying, no, don't use that quote.
Well, then you get, you know, a hindsight.
Yeah.
And that's bad.
Absolutely. Or you get people claiming, well, he didn't say that. Well, actually, you know, there were two of us here and one of us was taking notes and he did say that. You can get over that problem in when you're covering politics at the state capitol in Albany, for example. Almost all the reporters use mini tape recorders now. I guess there's no tape, mini recorders. And that has changed the dynamic because now you have actual words spoken by those politicians.
Well, yes, except that there's another way of looking at that, and that is that it's verboten, right, to do it over the telephone without telling somebody?
No. In the state of New York, as long as one party knows, that's legal.
You mean the person who's doing it?
Yeah.
I remember talking to a reporter once who called me up to check a quote. And I said, no, I didn't say that. He said, well, let me go back and check my notes. And I knew damn well it wasn't his notes he was checking.
It's unethical, I think, to tape somebody without letting them know, but it's not illegal.
Can't do it for the radio.
The problem, I think, and like Rex, I haven't been a reporter longer ago than Rex. 1983 was when I was last a reporter. The problem for the print press in particular is that there used to be a time when interview subjects understood what it was all about to be interviewed, took the risk to the extent that there was a risk that perhaps their words would not be construed correctly or transcribed correctly, but they understood that that was the method by which they were going to have to deal to get their point of view across. I think what we're seeing now, because of the number of media outlets and blogs and everything else that there is out there, that if I, as a newspaper reporter, say to you as an interview subject, I will not agree to those preconditions, and thus we will not have that interview, they're not terribly crushed by it because it's our loss, not theirs, because they can get their word out.
They have so many other avenues to get the word out.
That's a very good point, Ira, if I do say so.
Well, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Quite welcome.
This guy's pretty smart.
Think nothing of it.
Right. Yeah, right.
That's what I read that in the magazine that had those pictures.
One of the people quoted in David Carr's column in the New York Times, a business columnist for Reuters named Felix Salmon, said this: requests for quote approval rise in direct proportion to the involvement of PR people. As the flack to hack ratio continues to rise, the number of requests for quote approval will continue to rise as well. And I saw something last month saying that now there are 3 people in PR for every person in journalism in the United States. So
yes,
we are
outnumbered. We talked about that, didn't we?
Yeah, I think we did.
Yeah. So. As for me, I like salmon.
But just to be clear, I think, as Alan said earlier, I think it's a good idea, not just that it's okay, it's a good idea when reporters go back and say to a commenter, did I get you correctly? Did you say it this way?
Mm-hmm.
And then that's a good way to show that you do want to be accurate, and it gives them a chance to correct the record. But
I always preface it by saying you don't get to make the final decision.
Right.
We encourage reporters who are dealing with especially technical topics. If you're dealing with science or medicine or something, you really need to go back generally to your sources and say, now, is this really right? If you have, oftentimes you don't have time to do that, and you really run the risk then of not getting it right. Mm-hmm. You know, getting it right is the fundamental, of course. It's what one of my mentors used to call the basic hack minimum, is getting the facts straight.
Now, the other thing that is much more frequent now, and I don't think it's a bad idea, although it has its problems, is the number of interviews that are taking place by email.
Yeah.
That many people are not going to be interviewed either because they don't have time, or in fact, they want to make sure that their quote is correct and they're writing it.
Or, in fact, they're not the ones who are giving out the quote.
Well, that's a good possibility. But the problem, of course, from our standpoint, the reporter and editor's standpoint, is that you lose that dynamic of the give and take. You know, here's my question, I'm emailing it to you, here's my answer. And unless you can really, and the source is willing to engage in a back and forth, you're not going to be able to do follow-ups and things of that sort.
Well, you know, it's very interesting that you bring this topic up, Ira, because we're sitting in this magnificent studio. It cost us a pretty penny to put this thing together.
Yeah,
it's quite nice. Yesterday, the lieutenant governor, does anybody know who the lieutenant governor of New York is?
I have to think.
Yeah, Bob Duffy, former police chief of Rochester, New York, and then mayor, and then here's lieutenant governor, came in. And I have interviewed a number of people who are not here in this, and the interviews are never the same when they're on the telephone as when you're making eye contact with the guy. First of all, I think it's better for them because I think I'm nicer. The more removed you get, I think I'm nicer to them.
You mean wait a minute, it's better the further away they are from you?
No.
I was trying to think, what's the phone number here? I think I'll call in the next
show. Except for a matter of search. No, but the fact is, if I'm sitting next to another human being, I think the probability is I'm going to be nicer to them than if I have some separation over a telephone where I feel, you know, protected. I don't know whether that's true for everybody, but I think it is for me.
Well, but there's a lot to say for you, being able to interview someone face-to-face and being able to read the body language and to see the nuances. It's just not
But
the
fundamental
same.
In all of this, I think, you're right about that, but the fundamental is that we need to be transparent with our readers, listeners, viewers. We need to let them know the ground rules that if there was a requirement that quotes be subjected for approval, as there was, for example, Michael Lewis wrote this now a very well-known piece in Vanity Fair about the President Obama after spending a lot of time with him. He basically got to, in effect, live with him. Turns out that he had to agree to quote approval, and he gave up a lot of stuff that he wanted to include in the article. We needed to know that in the text of the article. We need to tell readers and listeners when something has been given to us by email rather than in person. So,
well, you know, the other way to look at it is this, Rex. Mitt Romney, virtually every time he goes out, you know, these days, he's making a mistake.
So
the Obama people are running a much tighter ship. You know, they're saying, look, we have something of value. We have the president of the United States. You want to be in his presence. You have to give something up. And we've talked about this is all a matter of negotiating, especially when you have despicable periodicals like the New York POST, which are out for blood. So why in the world would you subject yourself to that? if you're a progressive, intelligent politician, and not make rules.
Well, there you go.
Well, the other one of the other
Why
lessons.
Why are you smiling that way, Rex? Because I've said what you'd like to say. Yeah.
Well, one of the other lessons from this Romney tape that came out, which apparently was taped many months ago and was finally aired now.
I wonder why.
Well, today, as we speak, the Matt Romney camp is distributing a tape of Obama from 14 years ago.
Uh-huh.
At a debate when he talked about redistribution of wealth. And the moral, again, is in this day and age of cell phone cameras and the like, and of course, 14 years ago, there weren't those, so I don't know where that video came from. You can, and much like Kate cannot take off her top and be 100% sure that she won't be photographed, you have to be very careful. And so if Mitt Romney, I think we all agree that whatever Mitt Romney said at that surreptitious meeting in May, he believes what he said. The question is, would he have said it in quite the same way had he known cameras were there?
Well, certainly not.
And then the follow-up question is, why wasn't he smart enough to know that there would be cameras there? Because there are always cameras.
I understand that Jimmy Carter's grandson had to do with this and got a heads up from Grandpa. Said he was,
yes, he was proud of
him. First one he ever got.
It's extraordinary. Yes. Right. He's never used the word extraordinary.
And what did
before.
He do in this? Carter's
he been... found the video on YouTube, apparently by accident, and he contacted the videographer and convinced him to release it or to give it to him to release.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now the video, by the way, was on YouTube immediately, which also goes back to a point that I've been trying to get my arms around forever, which is how do these things go viral? A lot of times people say, you know, somebody posted a video on YouTube and it's got a million views already. Now, here's one that was posted many, many months ago, and it just sort of stayed there. We used to say in the Bronx, it laid there like a
until
lox.
Until James Carter IV saw and it and began to court the person via Twitter, by the way, used the social media to connect with the originator of this and managed to convince him to let Mother Jones have it. And, you know, in that instance, though, Mother Jones is a rather obscure publication with a significant left coast readership, it nevertheless had the same impact as if that video had been given to the New York Times, because it was immediately picked up by all the media and everybody has been running with it.
Which, of course, gives a lot of incentive to somebody like Mother Jones to do, because, you know, all of a sudden the name is on everybody's lips.
Absolutely. If you're just joining us, it's the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok over there, Ira Fussfeld and Rex Smith. We're here every week to give a little analysis, commentary, and if you're lucky, insight into the media issues of the week. Now, what about this question of the cover story of Newsweek? Muslim rage, it said. Now, Newsweek under Tina Brown has been doing some controversial covers. They did, I'm trying to remember what it was, but there was something else that was very significant the other day that we were commenting about. The first gay president with President Obama, which got a lot of attention. Time magazine did one of mom breastfeeding a baby on the cover. These news magazines trying to reinvent themselves are going with provocative covers. So Muslim rage, the writer says, how I survived it, how we can end it. And that was the way they talked about the unrest rifling through the Middle East as a result, allegedly, of the video that is out there.
And the controversy is what?
That it was an inappropriate way to refer to it, that in fact, Muslim is not the salient characteristic here, that these are Islamist extremists, any more than you would have that the cover story, the cover line on the destruction of the courthouse in Oklahoma City would have been Christian rage. That this really is...
I don't think... It's really make a very good point. I don't think we would have found it acceptable to have Christian rage.
Would we say Jewish rage in the war of words between Israel and Iran?
No.
You would not have used that. You wouldn't
not
say
me?
You wouldn't use.
No, I don't think
Jewish
they rage. Would use it.
Oh.
I think they look at their constituency.
Yeah.
And their constituency in America doesn't really have the kind of Muslim population that a magazine like Newsweek would have to worry about in terms of sales or buying, you know, ads or the rest of it. Whereas I think if you said Jewish rage, you might get a little.
So the
bit
concern
of...
is by saying Muslim rage, they're inaccurately inflaming the public. That seems to be the gist of it.
Yeah, against Muslims as opposed to against Islamist extremists who are taking advantage of this thing.
Well, one of the things you said earlier, I mean, magazine covers are always very important for, I mean, you see every year there's a report of what were the biggest newsstand sales of magazines by title. And certainly now more than ever, these news magazines have got to do things to draw attention to themselves because they're in worse shape, frankly, than newspapers.
Newsweek circulation dropped 31.6% in 2010 alone and 3.4% last year. So imagine if your newspaper had lost 34% of its circulation, 35% in 2 years.
Yeah.
That would be
a lot of newspapers are losing them, but not quite that fast.
Right. So you're saying in your usual way, Rex, tut, 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 this is terrible the way they're doing this. And so the question then is, if you were Tina Brown and you were brought in there to revive the magazine and to, as you guys have said, reinvent yourself, don't you think that you might be led to do the exact same thing?
Might indeed. Yes, I think so. I think it's the same thing Ira was saying about if you were the publisher of Chi.
CHI, but it's an Italian magazine.
So we don't know how they speak in Italian. Okay, so if you were the publisher of Chi, you might have gone ahead and published Kate Middleton sans shirt, but you know, you might not if you were the publisher of the Daily Freeman of Kingston, New York, or the editor of the Times Union.
Although I wonder whether we would have, whether my thinking would have changed had Kate and William been vacationing in the Catskills.
Well,
now does that change? I'll throw it.
Let's ask you.
Yeah, I think the answer is we would probably not have published it without the black tape across the bosom because of we are a family newspaper. But if my photographer, who happens to live in the Northwest Catskills, happened to find out that they were there and she had the equipment, which we currently do not provide her because it's too expensive.
Oh, you're a photographer, right?
Yes, a photographer. I think we would give that a good hard look. To be
Who
folks.
Uses the word bosom anymore?
Well, I was trying to be nice. This is public radio.
This is a very finely tuned
aren't we bosom buddies here?
This is a great thing. We are. So what about the jerk who made that video? Here's an interesting thing. This is Jeff Jarvis, who is a...
he's a professor. He's a media critic. He's a gadfly. He's a member of the advisory board of the Journal Register Company, which runs my newspaper.
Yeah, uh-oh. He's a gas bag. he says he's the very definition of a troll, the person who made that video.
What
he
is a troll against somebody
who made it
trouble?
To elicit the reaction he was sure he would cause. That's what trolls do. Trolls are people who come onto your websites, to your blogs, and make provocative comments, nasty things, and turn the conversation one way or another, right?
Yeah,
is that a good definition?
Right. Yeah, they're gadflies, but not in the nicest sense.
They make the bait, and they often come under what are called sock puppets. They make up different names for themselves. They post to your blogs as somebody other than...
And they don't give a damn if people are dying because of something stupid that they've done.
Right. I can't quite tell what Jeff Jarvis is saying here because I'm reading his column and I've read it two or three times and I can't, he initially says, ignore them. But he also says, you have to learn how to deal with speech and value it. I guess what he's saying is go ahead and let them post, but then ignore them.
And I think he's also suggesting that those people who get exercised by what a troll says should be ignoring them. And that's,
I see.
And that's not unlike what, you know, somebody will, in the old days, react negatively. I get a call from, say, a politician who objects to a letter to the editor that we ran that was critical of them. And what can we do to rectify it, or what can he do to rectify it? And more often than not, I will tell people to ignore it, because more people will see the response than will have seen the initial complaint.
This is what I do when Alan says something provocative in this program. I just ignore it.
No.
I'm not, well, not I've been, referring I've, to you as I've, a troll, Mike.
You just gave me one of those sort of placid, you know, condescending smiles.
Well, Alan likes to respond to his personal mail by firing back, and I've often advised him in my role as
not always
board member of the station that let him be.
Not always. I often say thank you.
Yes, you do. You have mellow.
That's all. When he just says when you get an email back from Alan, it just says thank you.
Yes, you know he's man. He's not a bosom buddy.
So beyond that, we're going to have to let it go. That's the end of the program. Oh, it's true. It's true. It's the end of our half hour. We hope you'll come back next week for more on The Media Project.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people.
They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.